And co-host Marty Dunn passed away on June 15th, 2020, and these final episodes of the Dave and Marty Radio Show are intended to serve as a memorial to his life and legacy. Talking to so many of Marty's friends and colleagues over the past few weeks got me thinking, what am I going to miss most about Marty as I get back to doing all the things that we used to do together? I think it's impossible to come up with just one thing, but certainly something that is definitely at the top of the list was the way Marty always reminded me to be grateful. I can think back to so many times over the years where I would be complaining during the middle of some prolonged speaking tour in my notorious Eeyore manner, and Marty would say something along the lines of, "Look at us. How lucky are we to be doing what we're doing?" And as with so many things, Marty was always right on this point. He marveled at how a couple of regular guys could be so successful in our profession, doing what we loved to do most, which was teaching and sharing our collective knowledge with so many great people. And Marty was grateful for all that he achieved, being a great family man first and foremost, but also being a great friend and colleague, mentor, leader, teacher, and lawyer. Marty really recognized the power of being grateful. Now, don't get me wrong, Marty was very accomplished at complaining about things, and in fact, yet another thing I will miss when I start traveling again is hearing all the complaints that he would come up with during our travels. But he was usually capable of stepping back at some point during our trip to recognize that we really had it pretty good and our hard work and perseverance had put us in a position to do something that we love to do. If I had one more chance to talk to Marty, I would tell him how grateful I am that we had such a great run together. And now I'm joined by Linda Thompson, who worked with Marty at the SEC.
Thanks. Dave, it's so nice of you to organize this and to let us all reminisce about our very good friend, Marty Dunn. As I was thinking about what to say about him, I'm sure I'm repeating what others have said, that he was smart and wonderful and funny as all get out. But I think the thing I keep coming back to is just how kind he was, especially to those of us in enforcement who were, frankly, the securities dummies in the at the SEC. Marty, as you know and as everyone has undoubtedly mentioned, has probably forgot more securities laws, security law than most of us knew, and that's certainly true for the enforcement types who think the only section of the securities law is Section 10B. And I was thinking about one of the first times I worked with Marty, which was some company was not paying attention to what Marty was suggesting needed to be done. And he called me up, and I can't remember why. I can remember being very flattered and said, asked me to join him on a call. So I went to see him in advance, and he told me what was going on, and I was so eager to be helpful because I was so delighted that Marty would include me in this. So I asked, you know, what should I do? Where should I jump in? What should I be talking about? And he looked at me in complete horror and said, "You say nothing. Your job is simply to be there. Think of yourself as a bouncer. If you open your mouth, it will only go south." And in fact, I dutifully kept my mouth shut and things went very well. And from that, I learned pretty early on that from him, this sort of great art of being subtle. And he was extraordinarily tactical. And we just had a wonderful, wonderful time. He was probably the favorite of everyone in enforcement because he both knew the securities laws better than anyone, but could also explain them. So as I like to think of it, he could condescend without being condescending. So he simply assumed we didn't know anything, which was generally true, and would explain it in ways where we, so that we could be helpful. And I think that all stems from, as I thought about it, Marty was inclusive before sort of thinking about being inclusive was something we all aspire to, but he was inclusive on because it was to his core. He honestly thought absolutely everyone had something to contribute, and he wanted to hear it. And as a consequence, I think we got to better results. It was always such a pleasure to work with him, and I will remember his kindness as well as all his other great attributes forever.
Thanks so much for sharing that. And now I'm joined by David Slotkin, who worked with Marty at Morrison & Foerster.
Thanks, Dave. I've been listening to the prior tributes and trying to think of something different to talk about as it relates to Marty. But I'll start with repeating a little bit of what everyone else has said, which is, aside from just being a wonderfully warm and friendly human being, he was, and no offense to Dave, maybe the best securities lawyer I've ever interacted with. He had an ability to see the way Section 5 and all the various exemptions and all the rules underlying those exemptions fit together, much like Good Will Hunting in the movie, where he can see all of the pieces of the math moving. Marty was playing a three-dimensional game of chess when it came to the securities laws. And even having practiced for over 20 years when I first started working with Marty, I'm not ashamed to say that I learned a lot from him and learned a really nice way to think about the securities law, and he was just a great teacher. So to take it to a more personal basis, I haven't known Marty as long as a lot of the other people paying tributes. I got to know Marty really well starting in 2013. I, of course, knew who he was before that, both through Dave and more generally just through the SEC lore. But in 2013, Dave and I decided it was time to actually put the Dave and Marty team together in private practice. At the time, Dave was working with me at Morrison & Foerster, and Marty was over at O'Melveny. And, you know, one of Marty's many great attributes is his loyalty, and so it was very hard to convince Marty to join us, even with the prospect of working with Dave on a day-to-day basis, which I thought was really the main selling point, I think, in the end, of course. Was what got it done. Now, I grew up in Montgomery County. Marty grew up in PG County in College Park, as he was very proud of. And we used to have a lot of battles and discussions and trash talking between MoCo and PG and all of that throughout this recruiting process. But there was one thing we could both agree on, and that was that the original Lido's in College Park was the place. Not to be confused with all of the branches of Lido's, which are very, very good pizza places, but the original Lido's. And even though by this point the original Lido's had moved over to sort of heart of College Park, it was something we both loved. And so the final push to convince Marty to join Morrison & Foerster with Scott Lesmith was a powwow at Lido's one night, where Dave and I and Scott and Marty got together at a table of Lido's. And for those who don't know, he walked in, everybody knew him, everyone loved him, almost like any other place Marty would go. So we had this powwow in Lido's, and it went on for about 2 hours, and I definitely had far too many beers to drink at that point in time, but I felt like we made a connection over a course of several hours at Lido's, and, you know, I found out later that Marty was very impressed with how much IPA I drank during that session, and that made me feel proud that I impressed Marty in that way, because I could never impress him as a securities lawyer. And so it's a fond memory I have of Marty and I, more in a social setting. There's several others like that, but he was just as good a human being as I've ever met, and as everyone has said, as good a securities lawyer as anyone has ever worked with. And Marty, I will miss you more than you could know, and I hope that you're looking down and seeing that you have so many admirers.
Thanks so much for sharing that, and that was a great night. I'm glad you mentioned that. And now I'm joined by John Saya, who worked with Marty at the SEC.
Thanks, Dave. What can I say about Marty? Marty was one of the smartest lawyers I know. Wicked smart. Keen sense of being able to predict not only where the law is today, but where it will evolve or how it will mature. I always admired that about Marty. But looking back on it, perhaps my most cherished memory of Marty will be what he taught me about this leadership, both of people and teams. You know, my experience with Marty working at the SEC was that he was a humble, engaged leader that really cherished teaching others. You know, one thing that kind of I remember in particular, right, is that he would do this thing, very simple, very humble, with our Friday afternoon ritual was he would gather a few of us, give us a few bucks, or we kind of pulled together a few bucks, run down to a store, pick up some snacks, pick up some drinks of all sorts, carry back some ice, and there would be Marty in front of his office, usually with a 50-gallon trash can, put the ice, put the drinks, put the snacks on top of the table, and an email would go out to the staff going, come on by, they call it the front office at the SEC, come by in front of his office, share your, you know, what you accomplished, maybe what you didn't accomplish during the week, but have a drink, have some laughs, have some smiles. And I tell you, looking back on it, that was the most effective staff meeting I've had in my career. Very simple, government-budgeted happy hour, in essence, by which it was maybe cost us $50, but we had a bunch of people come by and share their stories, and maybe most importantly, have a few laughs, have a few drinks, and then plenty of smiles, and that was all credit to Marty. That was his leadership style. He connected with the people, and people connected with him as a result of that. That's one of my favorite stories about Marty. I owe that to him. The other thing which always kind of makes me smile is he was an incredible presenter. He had the ability to go into complex subjects, distill them down to basic components, to teach people, but also to make it real. And so often he would speak at, you know, national conferences, obviously a lot of it SEC-focused. And I remember one in particular in D.C. It was this mammoth conference room. It was probably 500 or 1,000 people in this conference room listening to a panel of national, maybe worldwide experts on some arcane topic. And there's the sixth person to present was Marty. And this is 45 minutes in, mostly lawyers in the crowd. Frankly, most people were probably, you know, on their phone or at the time Blackberries, I think, reading whatever. And mind you, in this conference room, they had put up these jumbotrons, four of them, I believe, on the aisle. And they had 20 feet in diameter, whatever else. And I was watching Marty as other presenters went through. He was kind of looking at the jumbotron and just curious about it. When it came to his part of the program, the camera zoomed in on him, kind of a bust from his, you know, chest to his head. And he just sat there bobbing his head around and remarking into a microphone, my God, is my head that big? The whole crowd erupted in laughter. They loved it. And so he brought a certain amount of levity and kind of energy to the crowd. They engaged, and then he went into this, of course, this brilliant presentation around some arcane element of the law. That was Marty. Connect with people, teach others, good sense of humor, good sense of timing, and a great all-around person to be with. Thanks, Dave, for giving me an opportunity.
Thanks so much for sharing that. I really appreciate it. And now I'm pleased to be joined by Bjorn Hall, who worked with Marty in several different capacities.
Thanks, Dave. Hello, my name is Bjorn Hall, and I'm currently the general counsel of Fundrise, an online real estate investment platform headquartered in Washington, D.C. I first met Marty back in the summer of 2005 when I was a legal intern in Dave Lynn's chief counsel office, actually, at the Securities and Exchange Commission. And then I later worked with Marty at O'Melveny & Myers from about 2008 to 2013. And I continued to work with Marty as a client when I left O'Melveny in 2014 to join Fundrise. The story that I wanted to share about Marty is how he and I came to represent Fundrise. So I believe it was around the summer of 2011 when I was an associate, and I'm not quite sure how the introduction happened, but there was this one day where Marty left, you know, to have a business development lunch down at BLT with this man named Ben Miller, who's, you know, a co-founder of Fundrise. And Ben, you know, he had been through the 2008-09 recession as a developer. He had seen everything kind of collapse. And he told Marty that he had this great idea coming out of it about getting the community, as opposed to just institutional investors, to invest in local real estate as a way to create more sustainable real estate development. And he wanted to, you know, explore ways that he could make this offering to residents of D.C. and Maryland, Virginia for up to $350,000 in this relatively small building down on H Street. And apparently Ben had spoken to quite a few lawyers at other big law firms, and they would all basically just scoff at his idea. Like, this is ridiculous. Like, what are you talking about? Why would you spend the time, effort, and money to try and offer $350,000 to the public? Like, just go do Reg D, file your Form D, and be done with it. Like, what's wrong with you? Like, this is ridiculous. But of course, Marty, being Marty, and being a small business capital raise guy, thought that this was just the coolest thing that he had ever heard. And so, you know, he hears Ben's idea, and instead of shutting him down, he's like, oh my God, this is amazing. You know, we should really do this. There's this exemption. It's hardly ever used. It's called Regulation A. And, you know, we can qualify this thing with the SEC. We'll have to, you know, register it with the state, but then you can go and offer these securities to the public. And apparently he convinced and spend, you know, this is a great idea. So following, you know, this lunch, he goes upstairs to a Melvin and he marches into my office. It's like, Bjorn, get excited. We're going to do a $350,000 Regulation A offering. And I just looked at him and was like, I don't know exactly what I said, but it was something along the lines of, Marty, what in the hell are you talking about? Like, our legal bills start at $350,000. How are they going to pay us? And, you know, he just literally was like, don't worry about it. This is going to be the coolest thing we work on. And, you know, again, I was like, 50-year associate. So it's like, okay, dude, I mean, they're your billables to write off, not mine. You know, whatever you want to work on, we'll work on. And, yeah, and so we did. And we worked on it. We took it on. And, you know, keep in mind, this is pre-Jobs Act Regulation A. So this is not Reg A Plus. This is, you know, you don't have covered security status. I think you can only raise a maximum of $5 million. So meaning you have to qualify it not only with the SEC, but you got to go through the state regulators. And it took us somewhere around 6 months to get that thing qualified with the SEC. And at the end of the day, we did not get Maryland. We only got D.C. and Virginia to take it effective. And, you know, I couldn't tell you what the actual legal bill was for that. But I'm fairly certain that we only ended up charging Fundrise about $50,000 for the effort. So that is nowhere near, I imagine, the effort that went into it. So, but that's, I mean, that's just how it worked, you know, with Marty. That both at O'Melveny and then afterwards in, you know, my life and career at Fundrise, where if I had things that I wanted to talk about, if I had questions or just ideas that I had, like, hey, what if we did this, that, or whatever, I'd call him up and, you know, pitch him ideas. And there'd be times when he told me, oh, yeah, that's a great idea. Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Then there'd be other times when he's just like, are you a moron? I'd be like, oh, let me rethink that one. And that's just how it worked. And so it's not an exaggeration to say that the Fundrise that exists today, and really the career that I have had both in securities law and at Fundrise, is directly linked to that decision that Marty made back in the summer of 2011 to take on some crazy $350,000 Regulation A offering just because he thought the project sounded cool. And if anybody out there wants to see, you know, what the result of that offering was, you can still to this day go down to H Street in D.C. and have dinner at a restaurant called Maketo, which is in a building 1351 H Street, which was our very first Regulation A offering.
Great. Thanks so much for sharing that, Bjorn. I really appreciate it. And now I'm joined by Tom Kim, who worked with Marty at the SEC.
My best memory of Marty at the SEC involved the 2007 Reg D proposing release. Just to set the stage, you know, it was a very active rulemaking period between 06 and 07 when John White became director of CourtFin. And one of the projects we had was to amend Reg D and to change, among other things, the definition of accredited investor. And of course, you know, the commission has tried to do these amendments many times. This was, you know, this is just only the latest reiteration. And of course, it has since been superseded by many other rulemaking projects on Regulation D. But in any event, what I'm talking about here is the summer of 07. We were putting together the proposing release, again, thinking about the definition of accredited investor and so on. When Marty came up to the chairman's office, I was then counsel to Chris Cox, and opposite from me from the hallway was Mike Halloran, the deputy chief of staff. And Marty came to our office with an idea, and he said, look, we're putting this Reg D release together, but why don't we put in commission guidance about the question of concurrent public and private offerings and how to apply the integration doctrine when you have concurrent public and private offerings? Because the five-factor test in Rule 502 is just not helpful because it looks to single plan of financing at or about the same time, same type of consideration, made for the same general purpose. When you have a private and public offering happening at the same time, the five-factor test is completely not helpful. And so Marty's idea was, look, if an issuer can demonstrate that, notwithstanding the fact that his or its private offering is happening at the same time as a registered offering, if the issuer can demonstrate that it located, it found its investors separate and apart from the registration statement, either because they had a pre-existing substantive relationship or its agents found that person, but however located, it was not through the registration statement. If that is your fact pattern, then there's no reason why that issuer should be concerned about having to integrate its private offering with the public offering, even though they're happening at the same time. And of course, Mike, who was a venture capital lawyer for many years in Silicon Valley. He thought that was a really terrific idea. You know, we had, you know, there was really not, there really wasn't a good place to put this guidance, but we felt it was important enough that we found a place for it in this proposing release. And sort of the big picture here was that, you know, Marty was on his way out of the staff. This was, you know, the summer of 07. He had decided that he had announced, or he was about to announce his departure. And in fact, this proposing release was published, I think, on August 3rd, and I think he announced on August 6th. So this was his last sort of parting shot, his last contribution to the securities laws before he left for the private sector. And this guidance that was embodied in the Reg D proposing release, it's very commonsensical. And I think, personally, it's very pro-investor protection. And to me, it perfectly exemplifies Marty's mastery of the federal securities laws, his deep understanding and his judgment as to what levers could be pulled or pushed to facilitate capital formation, yet at the same time maintaining investor protection. And this is exactly the type of observation that he made that would really enable the development of the law in a very productive way, would give a lot of comfort to the practitioners as they advise companies through these types of fact patterns, but in a way that doesn't detract at all from policies underlying the 33 Act or underlying the doctrine of integration. And so Mike and I, with Marty's assistance, we then developed the guidance, then we sold it to the other commissioners, and then it was published in August of 07. Marty leaves the building, and then, of course, the proposing release goes nowhere, as many other Reg D proposing releases, and yet we did have this commission guidance. And yet when I became chief counsel in November of 07, and a fact pattern came across my desk. And of course, the staff, they were not mindful of the fact that the commission had done something very important in an otherwise very unimportant release, that the commission had actually issued this guidance, that it was actually interpretive guidance. It didn't need any further action by the commission. And it took me many months to convince my fellow staffers as to this change in the way we approach concurrent public and private offerings with respect to integration. And it, you know, it took another year for me to finally issue when I realized that the proposed rulemaking was going nowhere. And of course, now the fiscal crisis had hit. It was not until like November of 08 that, you know, we finally issued the CDI 139.25 that basically said, look, cross-referencing back to the 07 proposing release, the CDI made very clear that the commission guidance had been issued in that release and that it changed the way the commission approached this question. And to me, it was just, as I said, hallmark Marty. It was so much fun working with Marty, developing that guidance, because he was just such a brilliant securities lawyer and such common sense. And, you know, I had many other interactions with him afterwards, but certainly while we were both on staff, that was probably the episode I most remember. And it just, I thought, was so exemplary of the way he practiced the securities laws when he was on staff.
Thanks very much for sharing that. And now I'm joined by Carrie Darling, who worked with Marty at the SEC.
Thanks, Dave. There's so many memories of Marty. He's such a wonderful guy that it's really hard to narrow it down, but I've put down a couple of highlights for all of you. I met Marty November of 2001. I flew to interview at the SEC. And of course, being, you know, November, I flew through O'Hare Airport, which I will never do again, but my plane was delayed because of weather and I had to spend the night in the airport. So, you know, going to an interview is already stressful, but having to sleep in an airport on a cot is not great. I showed up for my interview. I actually ended up on time the next morning and I met Marty and he said, wow, do you want a beer? And I said, no, I think I'll fall asleep. And he said, do you want to like lie down on the couch? He had a couch in his office and he's like, you can go lie down over there. I said, no, I'm fine. But it was first meeting him is after spending the night in an airport. Then he said, tell me why I should hire you. And I did, and he hired me, and that started a long, long friendship with him. Working at the SEC, he was like our ambassador. He was, you know, Mr. Securities Law, Mr. SEC. He was the most human securities lawyer you will ever meet. And I just loved having him represent all of us, because sometimes people think lawyers are a little stiff, and securities lawyers may be a little stiff and geeky, but not Marty. Marty was, you know, full of life, personable, funny. He was like our best ambassador. We were at SEC Speaks or something, and it was very serious. Most of the SEC go, it's, you know, in February, it's in D.C., everybody dresses and, you know, suits. And he was speaking and on a panel, and he just stopped and looked at the projector screen, which is as high as the house, and he says, oh, my God, the head is huge, right in the middle of the panel. And everyone was just laughing, and we just thought that was just delightful. And I still remember that to this day. It was years and years ago, but every time I see him up on a panel and a huge screen, I think of that time. After the SEC, we stayed in touch. We got to be friends. We would meet up once or twice a year at conferences, Marty, Dave, and I. So it was always wonderful to be able to catch up and see him. We went to New Orleans, Vegas, San Diego several times, Palo Alto, San Francisco. And whenever I asked if he could speak on a panel, I would call Dave, see if he could speak on a panel. Dave's like, I'm in. Reach out to Marty. And he said, if you and Dave are there, I'm in. Always willing to help, always willing to be with us. And of course, his puppeteering is infamous. So I always remember that on panels too. His knowledge was amazing. He knew every single securities rule and regulation. He worked on many of them, wrote many of them, but could just recite them forwards and backwards. I mean, it's just amazing. Brock used to tease me about my securities law heroes and joked about that I had trading cards of Marty and, of course, Dave and Alan Dye and all the rest of them. But Marty was my hero. And I always had a picture of him and Dave, usually from a conference, and I would have it on my phone or my screensaver on my computer, and I always thought that was pretty silly. What I always remember, too, is every time we met up at a conference, we would have dinner or lunch or hang out. He always talked about his wonderful wife and kids every single time we met. There was not a time he didn't go into how they were all doing and what was going on. He said his wife was a wonderful woman. Just, I mean, he couldn't say enough wonderful things about her. And he told me about the beach house they were working on together and designing it and the plot of land and the decorations and everything. He was just so excited to be doing that and just loved his family so much. And he was just such a good friend. He was always willing to help, always willing to chat, just a great guy. A great, great guy, and he will be dearly missed. So, Dave, thanks a lot for doing this.
Thanks very much for sharing that. And now I'm joined by Scott Lesmus, who got to work with Marty at O'Melveny and Morrison & Foerster.
Thanks, Dave, and just want to thank you for doing these sessions. It's really been great to hear all the stories, and I know everyone who knew and loved Marty appreciates it, including his family. So just want to thank you for that. Yeah, I'm fortunate enough to have known Marty for about 20 years and work very closely together with him for the last 11 plus years. So I've had a chance to spend a lot of time with him and we became very good friends. And it's tough to boil down all those great years I had with Marty into a couple of minutes, but there are a few things that stand out that I'll touch upon. And the first, which I know everyone who worked with Marty knew Marty, that really stands out is just his brilliance in the securities laws, depth of knowledge, and it was just amazing. And being able to work side by side with him and see that on a regular basis was really something. And his ability to simplify and synthesize the issues and apply the law was really something. And we had kind of this running joke or more dig on me because I worked at Fannie Mae for a number of years before I went back into private practice with Marty. And Fannie Mae is exempt from the 33 Act. And so whenever I would say, hey, Marty, I've got a 144 or whatever question that I'd like to bounce off of you, his standard dig would be, oh, yeah, I forgot that you worked in an exempt environment for all those years. So, but it was all good natured and appreciate all his help. I learned a lot from him over those years. And, yeah, it didn't come by chance for him. I mean, he certainly had a brilliant mind, but he used to tell me that when he was a youngster at the SEC, he used to spend his lunch hours in the library digging through old releases and materials to make sure that he had a real deep understanding. I don't know if he was BSing me on that, but it would not surprise me given how great he was at those things. And just the other thing I'll mention is just what a good friend to me he was over the years. You know, he brought me into O'Melveny and brought me over to Morrison & Foerster with him. And yeah, there's two things that it really had a positive impact on my life, and I'll never be able to repay that. And just otherwise, and we talked just about every day, or texted just about every day, and a lot of it about work, but a lot of it just about life and those sorts of things. And you know, whenever we would have a work thing to talk about, you know, he'd say, "Well, we'll get to the work thing, but how are you doing? How's everything? How's your family? How are you dealing with this, the coronavirus and being sequestered and working from home and all that stuff?" And so he was a very caring individual, and that part just really sticks out. He was a great friend, and I miss him a lot. But I have a lot of great memories, and we'll never forget the time we had together.
Thanks very much for sharing that, Scott. Marty was a great friend and colleague, and we were truly fortunate to have had a chance to spend so much time with him. I would like to thank everyone who took the time to share their memories and stories with me and everyone who has listened to these farewell episodes. Rest in peace, Marty.